Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. All right. So our first hour and 15 minutes or so, we talked with Jana Reese just about her life. And this is kind of the second segment. So welcome back, listeners. And now we are going to dive into what I consider to be a delightful book. We introduced it at the beginning of the show. It's called Flunking Sainthood, A Year of Breaking the Sabbath, Forgetting to Pray, and Still Loving My Neighbor by Jana Reese. And Jana, I'm just going to be honest with you. I read your book on a flight to and from Washington, D.C. And after like 2 hours of reading your book, I got this incredible urge to call you just to say I love you. That's all I wanted to say. Jana Reese, I love you. People picked me up at the airport, so I wasn't able to do that. But that's how I felt about your book, frankly. And I want to dive into it. So what introduction do you want to give about the book before I start peppering you with questions?
Well, I guess, first of all, I want to say that's very amazing to hear. And it has been so cool to have readers who are strangers. I mean, you know me, and so it would not be bizarre for you to call me up and say, you know, nice job, or I loved your book. But to have total strangers contact me and tell me how they responded, they want to be friends with me after reading the book. And that is just about the greatest compliment that I could be paid. I'm so amazed.
Yeah, well, it's also, I think the past hour and 15 minutes that we just went through is really relevant here. And let me tell you why I say I love you. Because, you know, I've been through I've been through some periods of growth with my relationship with the church and a lot of the binary thinking that I was raised to have kind of is unraveled. And, you know, I'm constantly figuring out whether I can really do this Mormon thing, even do this Jesus, you know, Christian thing, like, because frankly, the type of spirituality and religion that I was raised with never really spoke to me. You know, it didn't end well. It ended with disappointment and disillusionment and a sense of, God, where are you? You know? Mm. And it's not all rainbows, like we say in the past episode. It's not all rainbows, gumdrops, and unicorns. You know, there's a need that religion fills, but we're not given a template for how to live it. You know, mm-hmm. Especially, let's just say, in a 2.0 or kind of a 21st century way that's compatible with whatever modern sensibilities we have. And what I love about your book is that it's sort of a journey into trying and attempting to live a religion or spirituality that's cool, that's like thoughtful and fun and witty and interesting and just downright cool, you know? And that's why I'm like...
Well, my inner ninth grader is thrilled.
No, because you're... It's just like, wow, well, this is an approach to religion that, like, I might be able to do this. And so let's dive mm-hmm. in. Talk about what gave you the idea to sort of experiment on various tenets of your religious faith in the way that you did.
Well, okay, so the book is called Flunking Sainthood, but that is not the project that I was originally hired to do. I was hired to write a book that was in the tenor of some of these year of whatever books, and to have a comic approach to reading spiritual classics. That's the book that I was hired to do. And I said, well, it wouldn't be very interesting for people to read about someone reading. So we need to add something that I'm doing to correspond with each month of reading. And then pretty quickly, what I was doing became more important than I was reading, and the reading became supplementary to the actual practices. And the practices are fasting as if it were Ramadan, from sun up to sundown for a month, trying to practice the presence of God in a meditative way in my kitchen while cooking. That's an actual spiritual practice.
Mm-hmm.
Lectio Divina, which is a way of reading
the
Bible.
Wait, say that word again. Sorry, the sound broke up. Say that word again.
Lectio Divina, which is a Latin term for sacred reading. And it's a way of approaching scripture in a very meditative, prayerful way. I totally failed at that. And then chapter 5 is giving up shopping for a month and trying to curb the consumer impulses that keep up that treadmill of just wanting more and more. Chapter 6 is called centering prayer, and that's crossed out. And then it says, the Jesus prayer, and that's crossed out. And it says, look, a squirrel, which probably shows you how well I did at deep contemplative prayer.
Prayer's hard.
I basically suck.
Prayer's hard.
Yes, it is. And that's, I think, one of the hardest kinds of prayer, because it's basically meditation. And I have monkey mind in a massive way, if you have not already noticed. In chapter 7, I was trying to live an Orthodox Jewish Sabbath. So not cooking, not using electricity, not driving, not working. Shredding my toilet paper in advance. That was something I did not expect. So lots of practices affiliated with trying to live like an Orthodox Jew. And August was a practice of gratitude, which I thought would be easy, and it turned out to not be easy at all. I had a September practice of Benedictine hospitality, trying to implement the hospitality of welcoming a stranger as Christ, which is kind of harder than it sounds. Chapter 10, October, was implementing Christian vegetarianism. I was reading St. Francis at the time, who, as it turns out, is not a vegetarian, but I did not know that until I was halfway through the month. Whoops. Chapter 11 is about fixed hour prayer, which is the way that Jesus and the apostles prayed at fixed times during the day. And in Roman times, it would have been 6 a.m., 9 a.m., 12 p.m., 3 p.m., 6 p.m., blah, blah, blah. You see this in the New Testament several times where, for example, Peter's up on the rooftop and it's 12 o'clock. He's saying his noontime prayers. You see a couple of the apostles coming out of the temple at 3 o'clock and something happens there. So, you know, there are hints throughout the New Testament that they followed the practice of having prayer at certain times of the day. And so I wanted to try that and see what it's like. And turns out it's not very easy.
Right.
And then the final chapter is about generosity. I was turning 40 the month or the year that I was doing these practices. And that month, I decided I wanted to raise $4,000 for charity.
How much
and
again?
So okay. I talk about
okay. How much?
$4,000 for charity in conjunction with my 40th birthday.
Ah.
And so that's about why we give, and really proportionally how little most of us give. Mormons come out pretty well on various indices of charitable giving, but most Americans give less than 1% to charity.
Less than 1%?
Less than 1%, yeah. And the really depressing part is that the statistic that they tell you is 1% to 2%, but then they say in the book, it's called passing the plate. It's a logical study of charitable giving in America. Then they say the 1% to 2% is really probably pretty optimistic because it's based on self-reporting and people always tell you that they were in church when they weren't in church. They tell you they gave money and they didn't give money. And they tend to overestimate how much they gave if they did give.
Right.
So that was chapter 12. And then there's an epilogue which completely undermines the comic nature of the entire rest of the book because of a tragedy that happened in my family and how that affected our lives.
Right.
So it ends a little sadly.
So it sounds like, you know, I once heard this sort of cheesy salesman-like quote that if you practice something for 30 days, it'll become a habit. And then, you know, sounds like you're going to become bionic, you know, religious, spiritual woman. If you could apply that through 12 months, you would come out the other end a saint, basically, right?
Yeah, pretty much not. It didn't really work out.
Yeah,
but
and
the point of this book is that it was worth trying, even if I didn't succeed.
Well, so let's explore just a few of your favorite months or the ones that you want to share. We don't want to we don't want to take all the fun surprises away from those who are going to march out and buy the book. But, you know, let's take a couple of the months and just talk about what you tried and what you found out and what your experiences were.
All right. Was there one in particular that you wanted to know about or that interested you?
I enjoyed so many of them, but let's just talk about fasting. So Ramadan.
Talk about fasting. Okay.
Well, Ramadan, right? Why not just the...
Why Ramadan?
Yeah.
Well,
in a post 9/11 world.
I've always been impressed by the practice of Ramadan and the tremendous faith that I found out it takes in order to fast every day for more than a month, in their case, just a month in mine. And I was such a loser that I chose the shortest month of the year. I planned the year so I would do the fasting practice in February because it's only 28 days and also the days are very short. So when I think about how difficult that was, and then I think about right now, for example, this year, Ramadan was in August and September.
Oh.
And the days, you know, the days are very long. It's just so much more difficult, even those extra 4 or 5 hours that you're fasting. So my hat is off to Muslims everywhere. It's kind of an amazing practice. What I found in trying to implement it, though, by myself, is that the communal aspect of fasting as it's done in Islam, and also I have to say as it's done in Mormonism, we do this part really, really well. The communal aspect of fasting is a very important part of the overall experience, that you are doing this with other people for a purpose that is greater than yourself. And I didn't have that. So for me, I discovered pretty much halfway through that I was fasting for the wrong reasons, and fasting thinking that I might lose some weight, for example, or fasting because I thought that that it would be good for my health. And it's funny because I'm sitting here eating cookies and I'm trying to be really unobtrusive about it as I talk. Sorry about that. It's dinner time, you know, I'm hungry. So with flunking sainthood and the fasting, my failure was not in that month that I didn't do the practice, because I don't think I ever cheated on the fast itself. There were other months where I cheated on the practices, but with the fasting, I was able to do the practice.
And tell us what that is. There's a lot of people who don't know what Ramadan. So the Muslims, you know, practice Ramadan, right?
Right. And Ramadan is the name of a month. So, you know, think of it as January or February or whatever.
Okay.
And so every month in the Muslim calendar, which is a lunar calendar, different from the Gregorian calendar type thing that we use, Ramadan occurs, and it's basically a movable fast, so that it's going to be at a different time of year. You hope that Ramadan is going to be in December or January, because it's a lot easier than when it's in the middle of the summer, as I said. Mm. And in Islam, 1.2 billion Muslims are doing this practice altogether, which makes tremendous difference in how you feel about it, and the fact that you have solidarity with other people. I did an article for my college alumni magazine a couple of years ago, where I went back to the college and I interviewed students from different religious traditions about how they felt in this new multi-faith space that the college had created in the basement of the old Protestant chapel is now this wonderful multi-faith space. And the Muslim students there were so amazing in that they would plan to get together before dawn on the days that they were fasting, and they would organize this so they would get together in their dorms, they would have breakfast together, and then they would get together again in their dorms at the end of the day and break the fast together. It takes a lot of planning. It takes a lot of energy. Apparently, the newest episode of this All-American Muslim series that's been very controversial in the U.S. shows the Muslim man who is the football coach locally. He's among the five families in the show. And because it's Dearborn, Michigan, and such a high percentage of people there are Muslim, a lot of kids on his football team that he coaches are Muslim, and they're trying to get ready for a big game during Ramadan. I mean, how do you do that when you are so hungry and depleted? And I mean, it's amazing. When Mormons complain about having to fast on Sunday, when a lot of us can just sort of zone out and take a nap or whatever, it's very different when you're fasting in your daily life. That's one of the things that I discovered.
So it's for, you know, let's say on average a 29, 30 day period, right?
In Islam, it's more like 40 days because their calendar, as I said, is different.
Right.
There are only 10 months. I'd have to look that up, but I think there are only 10 months in the Islamic lunar calendar.
So for 40 days, they don't eat when the sun is shining.
Right.
They have to eat right before and right after, right?
And I found out I took this part out of the book just because it was running long, but I'm sure I'll put it in a post at some point. I found out after I'd started the practice that it's not just food and water. You know, they also don't fast from water. You cannot kiss your spouse.
What?
Because you might accidentally exchange saliva and swallow their saliva, which would be sustenance for you. I'm not making this up. And you can't brush your teeth except before the fast begins and after it ends. You were to swallow some of the saliva that is generated when you brush your teeth, etc. I mean, there are all kinds of rules. And, you know, just like in Mormonism or any other religion, there are people who are very hard and fast about those rules and people who are much more loosey-goosey. There's a lot of diversity. So I didn't do that total extreme, especially because when you're fasting and you don't brush your teeth, it's really bad.
Yeah. Does that mean they abstain from any sexual relations or not?
Yes, and that's not part of, you know, obviously the sustenance part of fasting, but the idea is anything that is nourishing, pleasurable, whatever, is on hold during the daylight hours and can be resumed at night.
Okay.
Although I didn't subject my husband to that. There's a scene in the book where I talk about how he wasn't really quite listening to me when I was outlining the year for him, and so just as a little marital test, I said, so there will also be a month where I give up sex. And then he looks over to me and says, wait a minute, what? What did you say? And I said, well, some of these monks were celibate their whole lives. The least that I can do is give up sex for a month. And he was really not as excited about that as I was. I can't imagine why.
So it didn't go over very well, huh?
No, so I decided not to inflict that on him. He had enough to deal with just trying to be supportive while I did all these crazy things.
And I just want to say that's, for me, that's one of the absolutely most delightful parts of this book is that every single paragraph has wit. It's just witty. The whole thing, it's just a delightful read because you bring a lot of sense of humor into what you write. A lot of kind of common language or kind of modern parlance. I don't know what the right word is, but it's just entertaining and fun. And I guess that was the point, right? You were trying to bring more complicated religious concepts just to the common reader. Was that kind of the point?
When I was outlining what my goals were for this book, as opposed to lots of the other stuff that I've written, this is very, very different. My number one goal was to be entertaining. I want the book to entertain people. I want them to laugh. The best compliments that I've gotten about it have been from people who tell me they loved a particular line or they laughed at this or they shared something with their kids or their spouse. That's just great. The secondary goal was to educate. And I think it's important for people to try to explore a little bit outside of our religious comfort zones. That's what I was trying to do with some of these practices. And to learn from that vicariously through someone else's experience is a bonus. You know, if you can learn about it a little bit by watching someone else completely fail, then there's a bit of great Schadenfreude in there. And hey, thank you for saying also that you felt that the book had something on every paragraph that you found entertaining, because I'm in a writing group here in Cincinnati. We meet, it's a small group. We meet about twice a month, and they went through the entire manuscript with me, and I would have them mark the paragraphs that they thought were funny. There was at least one thing that made them laugh. And if too long had gone without a laugh, I would just cut it. And so the book is a lot shorter now than it was at one time.
But that's
was a good editing process.
Yeah, so in the, like on page 14, a Christian friend asks you, so have you had any visions yet? And your response was, only of casseroles.
Yes, I had a lot of visions of casseroles. I used to watch, and I don't do this as much anymore, but I used to watch the Food Network while I would fold laundry. And one time Phil came up here, I'm up in the third floor in the attic where I was watching the TV back then, and he would say, why are you doing this to yourself? You know, you're fasting, and yet you're making yourself watch Einegarten creating something absolutely amazing. What is this about? But I was so drawn to thinking about food and dreaming about food that I just couldn't turn away from it.
Yeah.
And I talk, on a more serious note, I talk in the fasting chapter about why do we fast spiritually? And I think for Mormons, this is an important question because fasting is a part of our monthly Mormon life, and it's on the schedule. It's something that we plan to do. We don't always follow through, maybe, but we at least plan to do and attempt. But we don't really talk much about the reasons that people fast, and I regret that. I think that's something that we could explore, and I've just written an article for Exponent 2 in the new issue of Exponent 2 that talks about the history of fasting in Mormonism and also about the theology behind it.
Has the history changed? Has fasting changed for Mormons?
Well, it has in many ways, especially logistical ways. You know, Fast Sunday used to be Fast Thursday. Mormonism had Fast Thursday just like in New England they would declare fast days and feast days in the 17th and 18th centuries, and they were almost always on a Thursday, which is why we still have Thanksgiving on Thursday to this day. It's always on a Thursday because that was the tradition in New England, that if you had a fast day or a feast day, it would be on a Thursday. And so the early Mormons who came out of that heritage followed that tradition, and it didn't change until well into the 19th century when they were in Utah. And it changed mostly for, from what I can tell, for practical purposes. It was just hard. I mean, as I learned, it's a lot harder to fast on a weekday when you're trying to go to school or go to work or whatever you do than it is on a Sunday when the schedule is at least suspended in some ways.
Yeah, it'd be hard to be on a business trip or, a business meeting with clients and you have to go to lunch.
Yes. That was the worst. You know, you go to these business lunches and you're just sitting there like a vulture, watching everything that goes in everyone else's mouths. And of course, they feel uncomfortable because you're just staring at them. It was bad.
So you had to do that, huh?
I did. Yeah. I tried to do everything by the book with that month.
So what'd you learn from your experience fasting for a month?
Well, like I said, that fasting in community is far more preferable, at least for an extended period time, than fasting alone.
Right.
And that also we need to be very clear about the motivations for fasting. One book that I read by Lynn Bob, who is a Presbyterian minister, it's a great book on fasting. And she said that the biblical injunction that no one can serve two masters becomes very clear when you fast. Because if you are fasting for, as I was often, the wrong reasons, if you're trying to lose weight, or even if you're on some big self-improvement kick that's not necessarily of God, then you are trying to serve two masters and you're not fasting for the right reasons. Another thing that I would say, and this is particularly applicable in a Mormon context, which is that there are many different kinds of fasts and levels of fasts. And in Mormonism, we define it in this extremely narrow way where we are fasting from food and water for 24 hours, and that's the only kind of fast that anyone ever really attempts or talks about. There are
24
lots of other
hours.
Kinds.
How about two meals?
Yeah, well, it's supposed to be 24 hours. How often people actually get there, I don't know. I can tell you I don't often get there the full 24 hours. Because, you know, I always have dinner at 4 o'clock, right? You know,
yeah,
that's just normal.
Absolutely.
Right. What was I going to say, though? So different kinds of fasts. The idea that if in our church, for example, you are or you are pregnant, or you are ill, or you're on medication that you can't fast because of the medication, we simply say, and this is that all-or-nothing mentality again, you don't have to fast. Well, I think that's really not what we need to be doing. We need to say, you don't have to fast from food. But there are a lot of other things that you could change in life
like
from
what?
That time, whether it's there are media fasts, there are, you know, digital fasts, there are Facebook fasts, which I find to be a very powerful kind of spiritual exercise. And I do that regularly from Saturday night until Monday morning. I try very hard not to turn on my computer at all.
Oh.
It's hard. So much of our lives, even on the weekends, is caught up with that. But because, for me, if I start doing it, then it turns into work, even on Facebook, because readers contact me on Facebook, or, you know, if someone messages me and it's about work, well, that's work too. And it's not that I'm so holy that I think that God is dishonored by that, but it's that I'm so selfish that I want to guard that time for myself, because I've learned that I will be depleted when I try to go to work on Monday morning if I don't carve out that time. And that is something that everyone can do, whether they're religious or not, having those kinds of breaks that are simply in the schedule. There's a great book called Hamlet Blackberry that came out last year, this last summer. And he says that too. The author is not religious, but his family does a digital Sabbath as a family every week, precisely because they are craving that kind of silence. They're craving solitude and just stepping back from the treadmill of a very busy life.
You said a digital fast? Is that what you said?
Yeah, there are digital fasts. Also, there are many different kinds of food fasts. Okay, so when I was pregnant, I certainly could not have fasted from all food and water, but I could have fasted from sugar. In the Eastern Orthodox tradition, they have all kinds of food fasts, one of which is during Lent, you fast from foods that are cooked in oil, at least some of the time. You might fast from meat, for example, or you might fast from certain kinds of meat. There are all kinds of fasts, and as long as you are doing it prayerfully and with the intent in mind, it's a fast. How we got this idea that the only fast that counts is a 24-hour fast from all food and all water is really beyond me.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's really good insight. I agree, there's a lot more power to know that everyone in the community is fasting too, and not just you.
Yeah.
There's just something a little bit nicer about that for some reason.
Well, and it's a powerful experience to know that other people are fasting for you. If you are the person, that can be a tremendously deep spiritual experience.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a question out of the blue. It's one of the ones that I had kind of right early on. To what extent are you trying to promote or hide your Mormonism as you write this book? Because it didn't, I don't know if you ever actually state that you're LDS. You might, but it certainly isn't dripping with that. It's sort of, you know, kind of traditional Christian. Tell me how you thought about to what extent to display or not display your Mormonism to your readers.
You know, I think that the book is 100% me, in that I am Mormon. It informs everything I do and everything I write and everything I say. But when I meet someone for the first time, I walk up to them, shake their hand, and say, "Hi, I'm Mormon," which, you know, that's just not me. So it's not that I'm hiding my Mormonism in this book. Anybody who Googles me is going to find out in 2 seconds that I'm Mormon, and fairly open and vocal about that, because I'm a Mormon blogger. So there's nothing hiding here, but I would also say that I learned a hard lesson about 6 years ago when I did a commentary on the Book of Mormon. And the book was published by a religious press that had done a whole series of sacred books on the sacred texts of different religions. So the Book of Mormon was among many of these other texts, like the Dhammapada and I don't know what else. There were dozens of them. And yet, even though it was part of this series and the accepted part, because it was a book that was not negative about Mormonism, some religious bookstores refused to carry it at all. And I got the royalty statement in the mail, and I had, you know, in my Girl Scout way, already decided and declared in the prologue of the book that the royalties were going to be donated to the Book of Mormon Fund, or no, it was the Humanitarian Fund of the LDS Church. And yet there were no royalties forthcoming from this book. And so I saw the publisher at a convention, and I went up to him and said, "Oh man, I'm so sorry. I think that's the worst selling book I've ever done." And he said, "Oh, worst selling book we've ever published," which was not fun to hear. But then he went on to tell me that he had encountered anti-Mormon prejudice. And as a Jew, he had not realized that anti-Mormon prejudice could be as akin to anti-Semitism, as it turned out to be. So he told me that a number of their customers refused to carry the book at all, and it just basically went nowhere except online. So when I was thinking about this book, I didn't want my publishing house, which is an ecumenical Christian publishing house, to have that same kind of experience. They've taken a chance by publishing a religion book by a Mormon author. They've taken a chance in the first place. I don't need to rub it in everybody's nose, you know, everybody's face, right, that I'm a Mormon, and hurt them, because basically that is what would happen. So people, the good people like Pericles Press, who took a wonderful chance on this book, don't need to suffer because of my affiliation.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a bit of a sobering reality. I mean, we live in a time when, you know, Harry Reid's Senate Majority Leader and there are two Mormon candidates for president, but it sounds like we're not out of the woods yet in terms of becoming mainstream, are we?
Oh, we're definitely not. And just last week, I had a very whiny blog post that described something that happened to me recently. The publisher has hired a friend of mine who's a book publicist, and she's phenomenal at setting up interviews and all of these. And she had set up an interview with an evangelical Christian website, and the two of the editors there had read the book and really liked it, and they were excited to put it on the site. And then one of the higher-ups who runs the site found out that I was Mormon, and so they pulled the plug on the whole thing. And one of the editors wrote to my publicist and said that the author is a vocal Mormon. And I thought, you know, I was really upset when I heard this. And I thought, it's bad enough to be part of a religious minority, apparently, but to not be ashamed of it is beyond the pale. You know, that's just terrible. So anti-Mormon prejudice is out there. It's very real. I don't let it bother me. My readers will find me one way or the other. I would say they're probably mostly not Mormon, my readers, but I have a lot of Episcopalian readers. I think that's so awesome. My husband and daughter are Episcopalian, and Episcopal Church has been phenomenal and wonderful about giving me opportunities to speak and to talk about the book. So
just in Cincinnati or all over?
Mostly in Ohio, but also it looks like I'm going to be speaking at a church in New York City early next year. And I'm leading a retreat, an Episcopal retreat here in Ohio in March. So, yeah, some good things happening.
You're an Episcopalian rock star, and your husband is accruing all sorts of social benefit therefrom, right?
I don't know if he would see it that way. Not at all. And I rock star is a bit of an overstatement. But,
oh, okay.
But thank
Well, so what's the point of, you know, you talk about on page 38 or so, as you're concluding your month on trying to meet Jesus in the kitchen. So it's kind of a, I don't know, is it fair to say a mindfulness kind of exercise where you're trying to, you know, in this chapter you talk about it's Brother Lawrence, right? And this is tell us a little bit about who Brother Lawrence was.
Sure. Well, Brother Lawrence was a French monk who I thought was a saint and turned out actually not to be a saint, just right. Like St. Francis turned out not to be a vegetarian. You find out lots of things about your heroes when you really study up on them.
Right.
And Brother Lawrence is famous for finding God in cooking. So finding God in the kitchen. He served for 15 years served kitchen duty in the monastery where he lived. And so his goal was to allow his love for God to suffuse every meal, like in a like water for chocolate way, but not with all of the sex. So I was reading Brother Lawrence and trying to practice the presence of God and finding that, you know, he just never really outlines how that's supposed to happen. And it was a bit nebulous to me how that was supposed to occur. But I like the idea of it. And so I'm going to read just a little bit of that, if that's okay.
Sure.
I like this little part. So it occurs to me that it's no coincidence that Brother Lawrence's writing, neglected by French Catholics after his death, was subsequently championed by English and American radical Protestants. His DIY spirituality coordinated precisely with their worldview. No intermediary was necessary. Just step right in, folks, scrub those dishes, and presto changeo, you're that much closer to God. Anyone can do it, even in the most profane of spaces. You don't need a priest, a scribe, or a Eucharist. You just need a cutting board and a cleaver, and suddenly you're flying down the spirituality express.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that Brother Lawrence has been so perennially popular because he opens the door for ordinary people to become saints. And some of the appeal of St. Teresa of Lisieux is the same, where she's called the little flower, and she says, I can't do much, but I can be a little flower for God. And a lot of us can identify with that. But boy, it's a lot harder than it sounds to find God when you're washing dishes and trying to wash your kitchen floor. Those are great things to do. But when we think about, a lot of housework is just about staving off entropy. You know, we're doing the same things over and over again. This afternoon vacuumed the bedroom, but with our dog, in about 4 days, it will need vacuuming again. And it's always like that. We wash the laundry, we mend the children's clothes, whatever it is, and then next week or next month, we have to do all those same things again.
Yeah.
But I discovered this great book called Keeping House, and it's by Margaret Kim Peterson, and it's about the spirituality of housekeeping. And she points out that actually it is precisely that never-ending nature of household work that makes it like the work of God, which I found to be a very profound argument. The first thing that God does in the Garden of Eden after the fall is to clothe Adam and Eve. And, you know, then he gives the Israelites manna in the wilderness. He always is asking for a house. This is one of the things that I found really interesting in the Old Testament. He's always asking for a place on earth to dwell. And so he's in an ark, then he's in a tabernacle, finally he's in a temple. And, you know, why? Why would God need that kind of domestic space?
Right. Yeah. And did you come up with an answer?
I came up with a suggestive thought. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's an answer.
Right.
But that there is something sacred about our domestic spaces and the import that we pour into them of trying to be Christ to family and friends. You know, in Matthew 25, Jesus is very clear about the sheep and the goats and the people that aren't going to wind up in the kingdom, whether that's a kingdom in the here and now or a kingdom in the far and away is unclear, but it is clear that the people who will wind up there are the ones who clothed the naked and fed the hungry and took care of the sick. But we tend to denigrate, even in our own families, the work that we do. I can't tell you, my husband just got home. I can't tell you how many times I've heard Mormon women basically, heard Mormon women reduce the important work that they might be doing if they're staying home with their kids as if that were not the work of God. And right. It is. So that was one of the things that I picked up from that particular practice, although I did not live it perfectly, that's for sure.
Sure. And in the end of that chapter, you write, I feel like I've missed the mark. I've experienced no spiritual epiphanies, no moments of transcendence while mindfully loading the dishwasher. And is that a comment on, maybe a slight commentary on what we should and shouldn't expect from what trying to live a religious life entails? Like, is it about sort of whatever endorphins you can create or move around through whatever behavior that leads to epiphanies or transcendence? Or maybe is religion about something more than just those occasional highs?
Oh, I think it's definitely about something more. And the answer lies in the acts of caring that we do for others. And this isn't just Christianity. This is religion writ large.
Right.
At the end of the day, where the rubber meets the road is how we love each other. And those sorts of housekeeping practices of cleaning and cooking, yeah, they're very repetitive. And sometimes you wonder about the point of them. But at the end of the day, they are about caring for either the people that we love or even people we've never met before. And that's the work of God.
Right. Right. Well, cool, Jenna. Well, I'm going to jump to a very direct question. I intentionally do not want to cover your book comprehensively because I want people to run out and read it. It is not going to do it justice as much as I think you're eloquent and I, you know, love my capacity to interview people. I'm just kidding. But it is not going to do the book justice to try and talk about it because so much of the art and the wit is in your written word and the experience of reading it. So let's jump to just a very direct question. What opinions do you have about how Mormons on average practice their religion that, you know, maybe the book, some of the experiences you had could help us, you know, in some fundamental ways, look at or approach our religion differently? Is that a question that I'm just springing on you, or is that something you can kind of run with?
Say the beginning of it one more time.
Yeah, what are some lessons you learned from, you know, this year of trying to live spiritually and failing in most of the things you tried, quote, failing, or maybe not failing? What are some particular ways that Mormons try to be spiritual or religious that maybe some of your lessons that you learned could help inform a more enlightened or a different approach or a better approach or just a different spin on how we might approach our religions differently?
Well, here's something that happened just last week. I got a message from a reader that I've gotten to know through Facebook. I've never met him in person, but he said that he had just recommended my book to his neighbor whose son came home from seminary and said, "Dad, I'm not sure I'm saved or that I'm going to heaven because I can't seem to keep the word of wisdom." Mm-hmm. And so, first of all, how did we get here that someone who is a Mormon teenager living in Utah thinks that his very salvation is connected with keeping the word of wisdom? Mm-hmm. That's quite far from the origins of that particular bit of revelation.
Because technically it's not even a commandment, right?
Right, not by commandment or constraint. And yet here he is believing, and also it's that all or nothing thing. Why am I even staying if I can't keep the word of wisdom and I'm not going to be saved? Why am I going to try to do all this other stuff?
Yeah.
So there's that question of all or nothing that we addressed earlier. But the reader contacted me and said that he'd recommended my book to this boy's father as just a way of looking at spiritual practice a little bit differently, I think, and stepping back from it and saying, spiritual practice is important and it helps us to grow, but it does not define who we are in the eyes of God. You know, whether or not we keep the Sabbath does not have bearing, I believe, on what our eternal destiny is going to be. It has a whole lot of bearing in how our lives look right now and how balanced they are and how beautiful they are and making time for God. All of those are very important. But we've got to keep spiritual practice in its place. And there's a legalistic aspect of Mormon culture that I worry about a lot, because those are the people that when they can't keep everything as perfectly as they would like to, they become so disgusted with themselves that they think they're not worthwhile, and they are. Having said that, though, on a more positive note, I would say that just the fact that we emphasize many of these spiritual practices at all is great. For example, keeping the Sabbath. Mormon culture, we don't do this perfectly. There's a lot of variation in how we do it. But we do have an ethos in Mormonism that there's supposed to be something different about this day, and that it is supposed to be about rest, and it is supposed to be about worship. And that is very well, I think. And the fact that we fast together is also great. I wish that we would also pray together. I wish that we would read the scriptures together. I wish that we would start saying the Lord's Prayer. But that's another.
What do you mean pray together? We do pray together. We pray every meeting. Beginning and end of the meeting.
We say a pro forma prayer, basically to get it out of the way. We're not feeling it. We're just not feeling it. I don't know anybody who's feeling it. You have the person giving the opening prayer. You have the person blessing the food. We do that because it's something that we do. The most honest prayers in Mormonism happen in the family and in the home and with the individual rather than in church. And until we as a people decide that it is important that we pray together as a people, we will not be able to stem the tide of people leaving, because if they don't have that sense of solidarity that's only going to happen through prayer, how are they going to stay? How are they going to find the community that enables them to stay?
So what's another type of prayer that we're not doing? I don't even have a conception of what you're talking about.
That is so sad. That is so sad to me that you can't envision what this
okay,
is.
Okay, maybe I'm playing an interviewer's role, but either way, pretend that I didn't.
Okay.
Well, what's another way of prayer?
There are so many different ways to pray together. Sometimes you can certainly do it by a prayer that has been written that people say together and then alternate with this time of silence, or they have some sort of litany, and that's fine. But to me, the most powerful prayers are actually the extemporaneous kinds of prayers that people... Well, that's not always true. I should say that the Lord's Prayer would be the big exception, and I wish we would do that. But the extemporaneous prayers where people get together in groups and they pray about what's going on in each other's lives. I mean, I've prayed for other Mormons, and they always seem surprised when I'll say, "Can I pray for you?" And they'll say, "Yeah, sure, pray for me." And then I do it right there.
Yeah, that would be weird. That would be a little weird, you know?
So that it's not just something I'm going to go off in a corner by myself and pray for you while you're on the other side of the room. No, it's I'm going to hold your hand and I'm going to pray to God for you right now.
Wow.
Because that's what we need to do. Right. Why don't we do that? That is so clear and obvious from New Testament Christianity that the early Christians were doing that all the time. We are all about this idea that we are supposed to be a representative of the New Testament church. And yet this is this huge lacuna in our devotional practice.
Mm. I see. Okay, so we could expand what we think prayer means. We can expand what we think fasting means, right?
Yes, I think so.
We're kind of drawn to a close. So any other ways that let's say you wanted to give a tip or two more about a new way that we could approach our spirituality, or a different way that we can look at things that could maybe end as a final teaser to make people run out to the store and buy your book.
Well, that's a lot to ask, but I'll tell you, I will read just this last little bit of the book about what I learned from this. These are small outcomes from practices that were done far from perfectly. In a culture that stresses perfection, I have often heard the maxim that good is the enemy of perfect. In other words, when people of faith aim for anything short of godliness, we miss the mark. I have learned the reverse is true. Perfect is the enemy of good. I may have spent a year flunking sainthood, but along the way I've had unexpected epiphanies and wild glimpses of the holy I would never have experienced without these crazy practices. A failed saint is still a saint. I claim the S-word for myself, even with all my letdowns. I turn to Dorothy Day here, who said that we are all called to be saints, and quote, "We might as well get over our bourgeois fear of the name. We might also get used to recognizing the fact that there is some of the saint in all of us. Inasmuch as we are growing, putting off the old self and putting on Christ, there is some of the saint, the divine, right there."
So maybe you're kind of saying drop this obsession or this emphasis on perfection.
Yes.
And loosen up and bring a little bit more of the grace that some of the other traditions talk about. Maybe we could stand to bring a little bit more of the grace into our own lives.
We absolutely could. And, you know, this is not something I've figured out, okay? This is something that I'm still struggling with because, as I said before, I'm a perfectionist. I'm probably one of those overachiever types who has to be taught that it's okay to make mistakes. But publishing this book, I almost didn't want to publish this book because I just felt like such a failure. And the book that had started out with such high expectations became this book about failure, and it never was supposed to be that. And I almost pulled out because it's humiliating to just put your failures on display for the world and say, you know, far from being the spiritual expert I was hired to be, I am actually a complete chump, and here is what happened to me. It's humiliating, but what I found is that it's so freeing to just be myself and say, yeah, okay, I don't always keep the Sabbath, and I can't sustain prayer to save my life when I'm trying to sit and meditate for 20 minutes. And what's more, there are a lot of people like me, and let's talk about that.
Mm. And it almost seems like for you, it's taken the pressure off, where it said, you know what? The first inclination is, well, I'm just never going to be a saint. But maybe it sounds like you've redefined what it means to be a saint. And to be a saint means to fail a lot and maybe to learn from some of those failures.
I like that. I like what you just said.
Hmm. Well, I'm sorry. I know you have to go, but I'm not going to let you off the hook. We always end our Mormon Stories interviews with people bearing their testimony. And you don't have to give a full and complete and comprehensive testimony. But something that you are is a Columbia PhD who's very well versed in religion and also a believer. And so maybe would you just share with us some closing thoughts on the pillars, you know, some of the pillars of your faith and what it is that would keep you enjoying and wed to this tradition that, to be frank, a lot of people seem to want to abandon. Maybe you could give a quick perspective that would make people maybe want to give sainthood, LDS sainthood, maybe another chance after their sabbatical. So
after the sabbatical, I like that.
So take us home.
I wish that I could convey the love experienced within Mormonism. The cookies that I was actually eating an hour ago because I got hungry, those were from the Relief Society for my birthday, just as a tangible example of, you know, how faith is enacted in community. That is not exclusive to us. But the fact that we take it so seriously is a beautiful and Christ-like thing. As far as Mormonism in particular goes, I believe in the Book of Mormon as a word from God about how we are to live our lives. And it has affected many decisions that I've made, not just in how, whether I joined the church or not, but how I care for the poor, thinking about King Benjamin's sermon and the many ways in which I fail to live up to what it means to be a godly society, and to that an entire society will be judged based upon how it cares for the least among us. And Mormonism, in the best tradition within Mormonism, upholds that and puts that in a place of beauty. And as I said, I come back to the idea of agency. I think you might have had to have been part of a religious tradition in which freedom was not emphasized to understand the glorious, revelatory, and radical nature of freedom. I think in Mormonism, we have so much to live up to in terms of how we are so eager to surrender that freedom so that other people can make the decisions for us. And the call upon us is to pray and to take the harder path and to work at it and become spiritually mature, because Mormon theology teaches that we all have it within us to have a godlike eternal destiny. And so if we are to meet that destiny, then how we choose here is important. Not that it's wrong to fail, thank goodness, and that grace exists. I'm so grateful for that. But the journey is ever upward overall, despite any regressions that I make or we make.
Ever upward, huh?
Ever upward.
I like that.
Over the long haul.
Right.
We have to keep that in mind. And we can't put all of this pressure on ourselves. Growth doesn't happen that way. It never happens in a linear fashion. Growth is unexpected and wild and unpredictable.
And yet it's worth striving for.
Yes, it is. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today. I know it's a little bit unusual for your listeners, and I appreciate them giving me the chance.
Well, it's my pleasure, really. The book is Flunking Sainthood. The author is Jana Riess. That's spelled R-I-E-S-S. Jana, you're just a delight, and I hope the church is as proud of you as I am as a fellow member to have you among us.
Not necessarily, but thank you. not always.
Yeah. Well, we wish you and your book infinite success. And so thank you, and keep writing. I know you got some other books coming, and we'll make sure to have you back. But thank you so much for coming on Mormon Stories. You've been a delight.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive, to the sand joy. Your hearts will swell, oh, all is well, all is well. Journey's through, happy day.